everybody. Welcome back. We're with Graham Norbury today. I first saw you, Graham, I think it was about 6 months ago now on the Human Unleashed podcast, or the first webinar that you did before you actually launched your website. Maybe August, September last year, maybe.
Yeah.
Fascinating insights. I've been all over the website and watched more or less everything you put out on YouTube. It's very different to a lot of the personal development movement. It's very holistic in its approach. Could you give us a bit, little bit about your personal history and where you've come from?
Yeah, sure. I'm from Lancaster in northwest England. Grew up there. Was lucky enough to go to a pretty decent school. We still had the sort of grammar school system there, and so I had an old-fashioned education. I then went briefly to university to study engineering, which I dropped out of quite quickly. Just realised that this wasn't for me. That was in 85, something like that. And then I decided to go and live in London with my girlfriend. Took a job, found a job very quickly. There was a boom in the stock market at that time, and they were looking for people who could count to 10, basically. And so I managed to get a job. In the stock market, I knew nothing about it, and I found it was something that I could do relatively easily. Most people consider it to be quite stressful, but for me, it was lots of complicated inputs and being able to sort of take the inputs, figure out what was going on, and respond. Something that I found myself able to do. Mm. So I spent 30 years approximately in stockbroking, which I found fascinating initially. I was able to live in London for a period of time. I lived in Scandinavia and ended up living in Spain for the last 18 years. But during the last, let's say around about the year, from the late 90s onwards, I began to get a little bit disillusioned with the entire thing. I felt that having been in the business for that long, I should have been able to figure out more what was going on and what was likely to occur in markets. Yeah, I don't think I'm a stupid guy. And with the experience that I had, I really felt that I should be able to predict events or at least outcomes with a little bit more accuracy. So I began to delve into reasons why I was not capable of making a fortune investing. I came across the sort of the underlying theory of sort of the monetary system. I looked into that in great detail. This was all in my private time. No one teaches you these things. And I came across the idea of sort of what is money fundamentally, what historically, what should it represent, why does it not represent what it ought to. And I came across, I think like you did also, concept of precious metals as a store of wealth and value and a means of exchange. Mm-hmm. And that represents a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the global financial system. And in fact, the majority of people that work in global finance have no understanding whatsoever of precious metals and monetary theory. And once I discovered that, I realized that that was the missing link that meant that whatever you're looking at in terms of investment is priced in dollars or pounds or yen or euros. And all those currencies are artificial constructs, which are not fixed in quantity. And it's clearly the system that we should be using, but we're prevented from using it because of the pressure from the pharmaceutical industry. So I spent many years studying Jack Drews. I've pretty much read everything he's produced and listened to everything he's ever said. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
And I began to implement some of his ideas into my own life and that of my family. And it just led to a much better understanding of health overall. And it offered a much clearer way forward to me. And then I met Phil Escott. In fact, I met Phil Escott. He also became a member of Jack's site. I didn't know him at all. He just popped up on Jack's forum, and he was a vegetarian, vegan hippie who had been crippled with arthritis. Literally, I mean, that was his. He wrote very well, he had a very entertaining writing style. He's very humorous. And he explained his problem. And he said, look, Jack, I'm not a scientist. I can't do the science. Just tell me, this is my problem. What do I need to do? And so Jack laid it out for him fairly simply. And Phil, over the next year or two, reversed his rheumatoid arthritis. Actually, psoriatic arthritis. But he was crippled. He used to be a fit guy. And he found himself crippled. He could barely walk. Whereas previously, he'd run a gym. He used to do mountain biking, play the drums, all these sort of things. And he was given a diagnosis by his doctor that he was going to have arthritis for the rest of his life. Here, take these pills, go home. And Phil, to his credit, refused to accept that and found a way to reverse it. And he's now absolutely perfectly healthy. Phil then went back to his doctor to try to say, look, I've managed to cure myself. Would you like to know what I've done? Got a waiting room, the waiting room full of 10, a dozen people out there who were all crippled like me. And so maybe I could share my learning with you. And the doctor sort of pretty much chased him out of his office and said, no, I haven't got time for all that nonsense. Wow. So Phil then began to try to share his knowledge online and having sort of little group meetings for free to just present to local people. So I went down to one of those, met Phil, and he's done the work. He is the embodiment of someone who has actually cured himself and reversed a chronic disease. Mm-hmm. He's got a very compelling story, but then some people ask him questions as to why does it work? How did you do it? So that they start to ask him technical questions. So I found myself helping him out with some of the technical answers.
Yeah.
And so we became very good friends. He set up a group on Facebook to share his knowledge again. It was a sort of free membership group, which started with a handful of people. He asked me to join the group sort of as the science-y guy, if you like. And it's grown from a handful to, I think there's 13,000 members now. And there's some incredible stories on there of healing and reversal from so many different chronic conditions. I mean, the simple stuff like weight loss and type 2 diabetes, which is relatively simple to deal with.
Yeah.
All through the arthritis, Crohn's, IBS. There's just huge numbers of people.
Pragmatically speaking, now you've mentioned Jack Cruise there. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Is a lot of that work focused on light, deuterium, water, magnetism?
Yes.
Okay, so pragmatically, because I'm not an academic, if you can sort of put steps in place, how can people use this knowledge to help themselves?
Okay, well, what Jack's done is he's written literally thousands of pages of deep science blogs. Mm. So that if you're a cynic, you can go there and you can see the real science and the real link. But he simplifies it for anybody who just wants to know the basics. And he's simplified it down to three fundamental terms that which drive health and life on Earth. And he calls it the three-legged stool: light, water, and magnetism. And light, that's pretty much in order of importance. Light is the fundamental driver of all things on Earth. It's the only energy source that we as a planet actually have. Everything that we get comes from the sun. And our bodies were designed, whether you believe in creationism or whatever the hell you believe in, but if you look back millions and millions of years ago when there was nothing here, the only thing that we had as an input was light from the sun. And so the organisms that eventually became us were driven by this light. And the curious thing about light on Earth is that it moves in a cycle. So you have the sun comes up in the morning and you have light. The sun goes down at night and you have the absence of light. So if you're a sort of computer programmer or a systems engineer, you can see that quite simply there, you've got an on-off switch. In very basic terms, the sun comes up, that's a kick, that's the on switch. Sun goes down, that's the off switch. So you've got two things to work with there. And then when the light source is available during the day, you've got various frequencies and various forms of light. You've got the simple visible red, blue, green, which is available first thing in the morning. You've got the infrared, which is the heat, long wavelength heat element of things, which is available whenever the sun is in the sky. And then as the sun progresses through the sky, I mean, the sun emits the same radiation constantly, but because of our atmosphere, when the sun's low in the sky, it has to travel through a lot of atmosphere to get to you on Earth. So the shorter wavelength ultraviolet stuff gets blocked by the clouds and the atmosphere. And then when the sun's directly overhead, it has a much shorter path, so more of the ultraviolet comes through. So during the day, sun starts off with red, infrared, blue and green at sunrise. And then as it progresses through the sky and gets overhead, you get ultraviolet A begins mid-morning, let's say in the summertime.
Yeah.
And then once you get to the absolute middle of the day, you get ultraviolet B, which is the most powerful. And so again, looking at your body as a receptor, imagine over millions of years, your cells have organized themselves. And so some cells are specialized in picking up the ultraviolet. So when the ultraviolet appears, that triggers another switch in your system on a bunch of different circuits. And then the ultraviolet B triggers another set of circuits. And then the ultraviolet B disappears. That's another off switch. The ultraviolet A disappears. That's another off switch. Then you go through to the gradual dimming of the light towards the sunset. That's another process. And then you get the absence of light, the total absence of light at nighttime. So historically, that's how, or ancestrally, that's how we evolved. We were totally naked, barefoot, wandering around on the earth, exposed to all that sunlight during the day. And then at nighttime, we disappeared into a cave and we were exposed to nothing except the fundamental magnetism from the Earth's core, which is also driven by the solar power in the first place.
Yeah.
And so the concept of health is, and then how, so I've mentioned light and magnetism. Water is the intermediary. It's the electromagnetic capture system that we have. And there's some work that has been done by a scientist called Dr. Gerald Pollack, who has published a great book called The Fourth Phase of Water, where he highlights just how complex water actually is and how it's misunderstood by science. And water has a fourth phase, which is kind of like a plasma phase. And so if you shine light on water, if you shine infrared light on water, the water molecules will respond and they organize in a certain way. So the energy from the infrared light becomes capped in the water, and the water structures itself and changes its size and shape. And we are made up of 70% water, 99% water by molecules, 70% by weight, but in terms of number of molecules in our body, that 99% of your body's molecules are water molecules.
Yeah.
So water is the device that we use to capture the vibration from the sun. And then once if you take water in a confined space, in a cellular space, and you shine infrared light on it, it changes. It captures some of that energy and it structures. And then the new structure it reaches means that it's more receptive to ultraviolet light. If you then shine ultraviolet light on water that's already been shone on by infrared light, the water absorbs even more energy and structures into an even more compact manner, capturing the energy and the information from the sunlight. So that's how our cells use light water, and the magnetism's really the magnetism's a fundamental sort of stable force which we get almost like a reference point that we get from the Earth, which is a fixed force. I consider it as almost like a fulcrum, like a lever. I mean, it's hard to conceptualize this, but
yeah,
those are the three fundamentals.
There was a guy, Walter Russell. I think he did a lot of work on electromagnetism. It was about 100 years ago. Absolute genius, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, magnetism is a very, very misunderstood force. We don't learn much about it in school, apart from little magnets and things.
Yeah.
But it's actually very, very complex, magnetism. And still to this day, I consider it as my weak point that I don't fully understand magnetism as much as I do light. So basically, Jack's guidance to people is get outside in the early morning and expose your naked eyes, naked skin, specifically the eyes. The eyes are vital to expose to sunlight. And you can stare at the sun. When the sun rises, it just comes over the horizon. You can stare at it with your naked eyes and there's no damage.
Yeah.
You don't want to stare at it in the middle of the day. So if you receive that on signal in the morning, and when the sun goes down, if you then preserve darkness in your house, you're living like an ancestral human being would. So you're respecting the on switch and the off switch. If you then get exposure during the day on a regular basis, you're again, you're replicating as much as possible how humans were designed. So you're respecting the original design of the human body. And you need to have obviously sufficient water intake. You don't want to be dehydrated, and you need food needs to be local according to where you live.
So that was going to be a question. Does the latitude of where we live affect these circadian rhythms?
Yes, absolutely. Because obviously, if you're on the equator, you've got the sun rises at the same time every day. Every day, the sun rises and sets at the same time every day. You've got 12 hours darkness, 12 hours sunlight. And so that's a sort of a simple rhythm to get into. If like us at the moment, we're in the sort of 50 something degrees north latitude, there's a considerable difference between the summer and the winter. So you've got this variation. So the on switch every day now, the on switch is slightly earlier and the off switch is slightly later. So you've got a variation, which our bodies, as we migrated north away from the equator, it seems that most people, the original human beings, they went back to somewhere in Africa, which is probably the Equatorial region. So as we moved out from that area, our bodies began to experience different levels of light stress. And so we've become able to adapt to a differing light input, which is slightly more stressful on our bodies. But whenever you stress something, as long as you don't break it, you're putting information into it and then it can rebound. It's like a rebounder. You're in extra stress, and then as long as you don't smash the machinery, that extra stress can rebound and provide you with ongoing energy and information. This all links back to mitochondria, because it's your mitochondria that are the sensors for your environment. Your genetic machinery from your mother and your father is the physical structure. Then every single cell has hundreds or thousands of mitochondria, which are bacterial in origin. And they come from your mother. You inherit the mitochondria from your mother. And the mitochondria are they produce the energy, but they also distribute and organize the energy. So from a computing analogy, your father and mother create the DNA, which creates the hardware. And then the mitochondria is the energy management software, which runs on the hardware. And the mitochondria they produce energy and they distribute energy. They organize energy flows in the body. But what they also do is they sense the environment. So they're incredibly sensitive environmental sensors. And so, and they respond very, very strongly to light and the way that the light affects the water that surrounds the mitochondria. So if you're living in an environment like we are now in Northern Europe, food that's available around you is also produced by the sun. All food comes from the sun, ultimately. And so when you eat food, it's not so much about the macronutrients or the calories or the fats or whatever the hell it is in the food. Food is... It's a sort of blueprint or a fingerprint, whatever you want to call it, of sunlight. It represents sunlight that was captured.
And if
you take it back to photosynthesis takes energy from the sun, water from the ground, and carbon dioxide from the air, and it creates a carbohydrate. Okay, so the sun's energy breaks apart the carbon, breaks apart the water, and produces a carbohydrate. So that energy is required from the sun to change those chemical bonds. And you've now got a carbohydrate, a more complex molecule. And within that molecule, because it took energy to make that molecule, the energy from the sun was absorbed, you have captured sunlight in the carbohydrate. So then when the carbohydrate is consumed by you and it's broken down and used as energy, you break down the molecule and you release, you do the reverse of a plant. Plant leaf takes carbon dioxide, water, and energy from the sun. And our mitochondria reverse that process. So we take a carbohydrate, we break it apart, we produce energy, we produce water, and we produce CO2. And the energy, when it's released, is used and it's captured in the water. It's captured in our systems for use later. But the key thing here is that the light that was originally captured in the carbohydrate is released when the carbohydrate breaks down. So if the carbohydrate was using high energy electrons during the summer when carbohydrates are produced in the field, the light energy that's captured in a carbohydrate is high powered summer sunshine, which contains lots of blue and lots of ultraviolet. So when the electron, which is the part of the molecule which is the fundamental particle that's captured, when that electron falls back down to its ground state, it's held in the carbohydrate above its ground state. When the carbohydrate breaks down, the electron falls back down to its ground state, and it releases a photon of light, same photon that was used to create it in the summer. And so that light has to be congruent or coherent with the light that your body is receiving.
Okay.
So if you're in England in December, there's no ultraviolet light, there are very short days, and there are no carbohydrates growing in the field. So if you eat a banana, which has grown in tropical sunlight, you can buy a banana in Tesco all year round. Mm. But if you buy a banana in December and you eat that banana in the UK in December, when it breaks down in your body, the photons that get released are high powered Caribbean photons from equatorial sunlight, and your body is receiving all this information that the days are short, there's no ultraviolet light, so your skin's not getting any ultraviolet light. So the structuring of your water and the structuring of all your molecules is suggesting to your body that it's winter and that you should not be expected to receive high powered molecules, high-powered electrons or high-powered photons.
Photon, yeah.
And so if you do eat the banana and these high-powered photons suddenly get released, your body is not structured to deal with them. And so they can cause damage and they cause confusion because your body's like, well, hang on, I thought we're in the winter and now suddenly we've got a tropical fruit. What the hell's going on? So you cause a disturbance in your overall body's, your overall body's vibration or field is structured for a winter program, and you throw in this disturbance.
And what would be the effect of that on the body?
Well, the body is always striving to gather as much information as possible. It's trying to measure when the sun rises, how strong it is, what the frequencies are, what the temperature is, all sorts of inputs that we're not even aware of. This is automatic. It's an autopilot type system.
Yeah.
And so the more information and the more accurate the information is about you and your environment, the better the body can make these fine adjustments. So you will run in a coherent, smooth, healthy manner. Everything will, like a finely tuned orchestra with a tremendous conductor, everything will just run fantastically well. If you throw in something that's out of tune or out of sync, like a banana in winter, it's going to sound like a bum note in an orchestra or a dodgy beat in a band. It's going to just knock you off. And so it's hard to explain what effect it will have. And the effect will be different in different people. But it's going to be slightly out of tune. And so Jack's view on food is that wherever you live on Earth, you should be consuming the food that grows naturally around there at that time of year. So in England, in the winter, nothing really grows. So you shouldn't really be eating any carbohydrates. You certainly shouldn't be eating any fruits. And you should be living on fat, animal fat, fish, those kind of things. And then as you go through the seasons, you get into the summer, late summer, and carbohydrates begin to appear. And towards the end of summer, we get fruit, natural occurring berries, that sort of thing. So I eat berries and stuff in the summer. Not many, but I have some. I have some honey, that type of thing. And your body's prepared for it because your body's receiving the ultraviolet. So your body's getting the ultraviolet vibrations on the skin and in the water. And that prepares the structure of your mitochondria to receive the high-powered energy. So the high-powered ultraviolet photons, bang, they get released. But your body's already primed for it. So it can handle them smoothly without creating any damage to the system. Whereas in winter, it's almost like you're structured for a low voltage system, and you can run on low voltage quite efficiently. And if you were to fire in some high voltage, you might short out some of the circuits. That's kind of an analogy. So you can damage yourself by putting in the wrong fuel at the wrong time of year. Yeah, there's no right or wrong thing to eat. But as you said, it's very latitude dependent.
How far back would that go, Graham? So let's say I was born in Africa. I've got African lineage, let's say 500-600 years. I was born in the UK. What difference would that have if I were born here compared to if, you know, I was born in Africa and moved here?
Here's the thing. It depends on your mitochondrial heritage from your mother. And so if, let's say you were born an English father and an African mother who was still living in Africa, but she moved to England, you were born in England. You would have African mitochondria from your mother, and you would be forced to adapt to your new environment in the UK. And so your mitochondria can adapt relatively quickly. It's not instant, but after a few months or years, they would have figured out a way of working within your structure. And the mitochondria themselves they mutate and they evolve much more quick. Our nuclear DNA barely changes. You can go for hundreds of generations with barely a change in your DNA. The idea of genetic mutation is very, very overstated. But your mitochondrial DNA, because they're bacterial in origin, they mutate much more rapidly, and they're much more adaptable. You know, why Mother Nature chose a mitochondria as the sensor, because it's much more able to react and adapt. And so if you've got mitochondrial DNA in the UK, you might find that in the winter you felt cold. African mitochondria, or equatorial mitochondria, it's warm there. Don't really, on the equator, you don't really need to generate your body heat. You rarely have temperatures that are cold enough to need you to generate body heat. That's called a sort of tightly coupled mitochondria. The energy that the mitochondria produces is all goes towards energy, direct energy, like this energy. If you've got North European or high latitude DNA, or mitochondria are more loosely coupled, and so there are points on the mitochondrial energy flow where you can siphon off heat. It's like a sort of escape valve, and you can release energy in the form of heat. And so people from northern climes have a much better ability to produce their own body heat and to keep them warm, because they've had, through millions of years of evolution, they've developed that. And so it would be quite understandable if someone who had maternal equatorial DNA, mitochondrial DNA, that they would have a tough time adapting to cold climates. Yeah, they could eventually do it, but you'd also have the situation where you would require more sunlight, because you'd be designed to receive far more sunlight. So dark-skinned people in Northern Europe have a tough time. And if you look at the medical history of dark-skinned people in North America or in Europe, they suffer from many different diseases, and their health is relatively poor compared to the rest of the population. And fundamentally, that's down to the fact that they're not getting anywhere near enough sunlight. Because they really do need the extra sunlight, because they're designed to do that. They have dark skin, which means to achieve the same effect, they have to be in the sun much longer.
Right.
So you or I could step into the sunlight in the midsummer, and within, if we took our shirts off, within 15, 20 minutes, we've generated sufficient vitamin D. Whereas you take a dark-skinned person in the UK in summer, they might need 2 or 3 hours exposure. So if you put that into the real world, we all wear clothes.
Yeah.
People foolishly wear sunglasses. We live an indoor existence. We get up indoors, we get into our car, we drive to work, we go into the office, we're indoors. And so the amount of sunlight and the amount of, if you think of the percentage of your skin that's exposed, it's your face and your hand. And so for you and I, that's a negative. But for a dark-skinned person, really negative.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they need 3 or 4 times the amount of exposure that we do. And so it's something that, you know, needs to be borne in mind. It's difficult to say exactly how much sunlight we need. But it's clear that we need the most fundamental thing is the on-off switch. The circadian rhythms have been proven to be an absolute fundamental driver of health at all levels. And so everybody needs to respect the sunrise and the sunset, which means getting up early and getting outside and getting the exposure. And everyone needs to respect the darkness. That's another fundamental key. We're supposed to be exposed to energy inputs during daylight, and then when the sun goes down, we're supposed to be in rest and repair mode, which is when we would crawl into our cave and sleep and repair. So the modern world has got that wrong at both ends, because we don't get the sun exposure. We cover our skin with clothes, maybe with sun cream, sunglasses. So we're cutting off the inputs that we're supposed to be receiving. And then when the sun goes down, that's the message to switch programs to the nighttime relax, repair, recover program. And in the modern world, we switch on electric lights, we stare in front, stare at screens, TVs, phones, until very late into the evening. So we then end up delaying our sleep cycle, reducing the amount of melatonin that's available, which is absolutely key. Melatonin has many uses in the body, known as the sleep hormone, but it's also the hormone that's responsible for repairing damage to mitochondria. So if you get insufficient melatonin and it gets released, melatonin only gets released after 3 or 4 hours of darkness, technically speaking, 3 or 4 hours of absence of blue light. And so if you're doing like the average person, you're staring at a screen until midnight or watching Netflix in bed before you go to sleep, you're telling your body that it's midday.
Yeah.
So it's switching off the melatonin. The moment you switch off the Netflix, you need 3 or 4 hours for the melatonin to increase, be released, and then it needs a few hours to do its job. So if you're going to bed at midnight, switch off your Netflix, you need 3 hours to release sufficient melatonin. That takes you to 3 a.m. And then you need a few hours for the cycle. It's like a washing machine. There's a cycle that takes place. And the repair cycle is supposed to happen every night. And it needs 7 to 9 hours of decent sleep to complete that cycle. Let's say 7 hours minimum. So if you're going to bed at midnight and you haven't got sufficient melatonin until 2 or 3 a.m. and you need 7 hours, you're going to need to sleep until 10. If you sleep till 10, you've missed the sunrise and you're probably late for work. So most people are going to bed at midnight, sleeping to some degree, and then waking up at 7. Let's say the average person gets up around 7. So they've probably had half the amount of sleep and repair that's required. So some of their mitochondria will have been left unrepaired. So instead of facing the next day with a totally refurbished system, which is the design, we face the day with a slightly damaged system. So then we're less able to use the fresh energy for the next day. We probably create more damage during the next day. And then if we repeat the process every day, you can easily see that you're getting insufficient repair, which leads to suboptimal machinery for the next day, which leads to more damage, building up an even longer list of cells that need to be repaired, and you've still got insufficient repair. So the majority of health issues today, and I say the majority, I mean the vast majority, 80, 90% of people's health issues are chronic diseases that have their root in the mitochondria, in mitochondrial damage. And that mitochondria have not, that mitochondrial damage has not been repaired, mainly due to lack of proper sleep. So we really need to focus on get yourself up early, get out in the light, do your shit, whatever you've got to do during the day, it doesn't matter, we've all got to live. Then make sure you block the blue light after the sun goes down. Blue light is the trigger that our body uses in our eye and our skin to detect whether it's day or night.
Right.
If you use red light, you can kind of get away with it. So if you use candles and red lights and orange glasses to block the blue light, you can get away with watching Netflix till 10 or 11 at night or till midnight. If you like, you can get away with it. And you'll still release your melatonin and you'll still get decent sleep, decent repair, and you can get up early in the morning and get on with your business. So those two simple things, get up early, try and see the sunrise, and block the artificial blue light after dark. Mm. That's the most fundamental thing that anybody should aim for.
Yeah.
And it nowadays...
Doesn't say, like, you don't need a degree to realise this, do you? It's not a difficult concept.
It's not at all. I just say to people, try to live your life. Okay, we've all got jobs to do, we all have to earn a living and all that sort of stuff. But within that, try to replicate as much as possible how you would have lived 2,000 years ago. Wherever you are on the earth today, consider what that life would have been like 2,000 years ago and try to replicate that. So get yourself out in the morning, do some stuff. As soon as the sun comes up, you should be up and active. And as soon as the sun goes down, you should be less active and you shouldn't have any artificial light, or at least no artificial blue hitting your eyes or skin. So you can get a screen for, you can get red lights and candles. If you want to watch a screen, which most people will do, you can get a cover for your screen, or you can get some software which reduces the blue, or you can get the blue blocking glasses. And you want to cover your skin, so you want to wear something that, you know, wear a high collared shirt. If you're a woman, you wear some sort of scarf. If you're in front of a screen, and wear long sleeves. So you can get away with modern day. Yeah, you don't have to live like a caveman. Yeah, you can still watch your Netflix, but you have to take some steps. And it may seem like, yeah, it's overkill, but it really isn't, because it's so fundamental. This day night cycle of stress followed by repair is how we were designed to work. We're designed to get damaged during the day. We're designed to receive stresses, to get chased by animals, to get injured, to get exhausted, to pull muscles, all these things. We're designed to do that. But we have to respect that we need sleep. And we don't just need the 7 hours in bed. We need the 3 hours of darkness before that. And that's, if you respect that, you will go a long way to repairing any damage that you've done. The great thing about your mitochondria is they can repair themselves. Mm. We have all these abilities in our body to repair our systems that have been damaged. Mm. And so most people, if you speak to most people nowadays, they don't sleep well. Even relatively young people. I mean, I have friends who are in their 20s and they have poor sleep. They struggle to get to sleep. They wake up in the middle of the night. They wake up in the morning. They still feel exhausted. And so if you fix that, you go an awful long way to ensuring that you will have decent health. And if you are in a terrible state, have, you know, a list of chronic illnesses, a very, very basic way to start is get up and force yourself to get up and see the sunrise. Get out as much as possible. Even if it means you work in an office, go out for a cigarette break. You don't have to smoke. Yeah. Just go out and stand in front of the building in the daylight 3 or 4 times during the day, and expose as much skin as you possibly can. Don't wear sunglasses. Don't wear contact lenses. If you have to wear spectacles to see, you can take them off. You can put them down your nose or on your head. Just get that exposure during the day, because the sunlight exposure during the day actually generates melatonin. So the more sunlight you get, the more melatonin you create. And then when the sun goes down, respect the rule of no blue light, and the melatonin you've created during the day will be released. It will have time to do its job. It will repair things. Doesn't happen overnight. That if you're young and you're a little bit unwell, it may only be 2 or 3 weeks and you'll feel fit as a fiddle. If you respect this for 2 or 3 weeks, if you're chronically ill and you're in your 50s or 60s and you have been ill for many years, then it's going to take 6 months to a year, possibly longer. And you may even, if you're living in the north of England and you're struggling, you may even consider moving somewhere closer to the equator for 6 months. Yeah, if I had something like multiple sclerosis or something like that, I would certainly consider taking 6 months off work and going to live near the equator to rebuild myself and then come back back to my original place in the north of England.
I mean,
that's something that Jack says. Yeah, on, Jack says. Jack says something very clearly, that it's not possible to get well in the same environment in which you became unwell. So if you just carry on doing what you're doing in terms of light exposure,
yeah,
you're not going to fix yourself. It doesn't matter how much good food or exercise you do, you're not going to get better unless you change the environment that your body senses. It doesn't mean you have to move.
Does this go to the argument of the germ theory, where it's like blaming the pathogen rather than actually having a clean terrain and working alongside nature to create that balance?
Well, the germ theory is that's a slightly different, because we're talking about, I mean, the majority of people in the world today are not ill because of germ or infectious diseases. The majority, if you look at the killer and the majority of people who go regularly to the doctor and receive prescriptions, they are chronic diseases of modern society. So the germ, the whole germ idea is a slightly different. So we had a small interruption there. So the germ theory is what's used by medicine and currently, and has been since the time of Pasteur. And it believes that germs are bad and your body needs to get rid of them always. And it's the germs that are at fault. And if you can sort of somehow kill the germs, then the body will be fine. Whereas the terrain theory says that germs are not necessarily dangerous. They're there and they may serve a positive purpose as long as they're in balance with the terrain. If the terrain is too open to the germs, or too conducive to the growth of germs, the germs will overgrow and they'll cause problems. So the terrain theory believes that you should maintain your body and its structure and its rhythms and its vibrations, or whatever you want to call it, the whole, any way you choose to describe what terrain is. So if you're in a fit state and your body's operating in a coherent manner, a germ should be no big deal. It will have nowhere to go, nothing to do, and so it won't cause you any problem. If you're not operating at 100%, let's say you're eating bananas in the middle of winter and you've caused some problem and you're not seeing the sunrise and you're seeing too much and you're watching too much Netflix at midnight, all these things will knock your body out of its correct vibration. And that creates terrain which maybe the germ will take advantage of. So the germs are also there to keep us in balance. The germs are there to, bacteria, virus, whatever you want to call them, they emerge when we stray from the sort of perfect coherent bodily function or terrain function. And then the germs somehow get us back into line again. So there are two camps. There's the camp that says the germs are bad, and there's the camp that says it's all about the terrain.
Yeah.
And then I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. If your terrain is, you can never expect to be perfect. No one can expect to have an absolutely perfectly functioning body. And so every now and again, when you get slightly off balance, you might get an infection and you might then go, oh, I'm ill. But that's just a message. That's just the germs are doing their job. They're there to counterbalance the moments when you get out of balance. And so they create this message and, you know, you get a stomach upset, headache, or whatever it happens to be. And that's really just the germs have triggered your body into responding. And that will, if you allow the disease to run its course and you recognize the message that it's sending, which is something's not quite, you know, I'm something a little bit out of line here, and you pay a little bit more attention to some of the things that you might be doing wrong that are causing disease in the first place, and then the whole thing should be self-correcting. But obviously eventually, as you age, your ability to self-correct and your ability to repair gradually declines. And so you're then able to withstand less insults and less problems. And so eventually we all die. So eventually there comes a point where an old person succumbs to pneumonia and dies, which happens in a lot of cases. Does that mean that a virus or a bacteria killed that person? Well, depends how you measure it, but what it really means is that your body's unable to return to coherence. No matter how many things you try, your body's simply got that old, worn out, and out of line that it's the end of the story. And then the germs are there to break you down, and it's the end of your life. You know,
as you mentioned earlier about you worked in the financial system, and you didn't know, you were working in it with 20, 30 years, you didn't know the reality behind the financial system. I'm supposing the medical system, in the same way, they could be working in it 30, 40 years and understand a lot of what's the reality behind the human body, because it's actually not given to them at university and school.
That's right. It's not, I mean, put some people, some people can be very critical of doctors, and certain doctors deserve criticism, in my opinion. But the majority of doctors are doing their best with the tools that they've been given and the information and education that they've been given. Doctors are taught an increasingly narrow syllabus of information. Doctors, I mean, as we know, it's a disgrace, but if you do doctor training, you do 5, maybe 7 years in total. And out of that time, I think they do 2 weeks at most of nutrition. So they cover the very basics in nutrition. And the way nutrition is taught to them, it's basically the same as the average Joe learns in terms of the food pyramid. You've got to stuff your face with bread and carbohydrate. It's appalling, but that's the way it's gone. Doctors learn nothing about light. All they know is that ultraviolet causes damage, but it also makes vitamin D. That is literally all they learn about light. And then they learn that if they shine a light on the pupil, it dilates. That is the extent of their knowledge on light. Regarding water, bear in mind, these are Jack Cruz's three fundamental principles. He believes he's distilled all explanation of life down to these three principles. Light one. So doctors learn like 1% of the story on light, not even that. Then water. Doctors learn that water is necessary, so we need hydration. So they can measure when you're dehydrated and things like that, and they can measure your urine and all that sort of stuff. But otherwise, they consider that water is neutral and negligible. When they're examining in cells, they dehydrate the cells, they take away all the water, and they look at what's left over. They look at all the bits and they go, oh, well, in this cell, we found this, that, and calcium and phosphorus and that and the other. So they've taken the water out. And they then try to figure out what might be happening. Whereas if you kept the water there and you examined it and you considered how the water interacts with all those different molecules, you'd get a completely different story. So they basically ignore water, whereas it's actually a fundamental intermediary in all reactions throughout the body constantly. And then magnetism, they don't learn anything about at all. So the three fundamental principles, you may not believe Jack Bruce, but I'm telling you, the guy is a genius, and he has distilled it down. He can argue the point that those three fundamentals, if you understand those, you understand life and health and wellness and illness. So if our doctors are not learning anything about those three fundamental things, you have to question whether their training is really appropriate for what they're being asked to do. And so it's quite unfair that they've been thrown into this role of trying to heal people, and they're just not prepared for it. What they are prepared for is and we know the story because it was so that the modern medical industry was created by the Rockefellers and the Carnegies in the 20s, probably. Mm-hmm. And they took over all the medical schools. They began to write all the medical books. And everything is geared towards providing a pill for an ill. So, and nowadays you notice that very, very obviously, if you ever go to the doctor, it's now the doctor talks to you for his 10 minutes and he's tapping away on his keyboard. He's asking you questions and he's hitting buttons, because the whole diagnostic process now has been stripped down to, do you have symptom A? Yes. Do you have symptom B? No. Click, 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 click. And then you press go. And at the bottom, it comes out with prescribe this medication. So the whole system of our interaction with doctors nowadays is stripped back to minimal level of understanding of the symptoms, minimal level, even less understanding of the what's going on behind this, what has caused the symptoms. But the machine just tells him, this drug will suppress those symptoms. So the entire system is set up to prescribe medicines. The doctors are running a sales and distribution job for the pharmaceutical industry. That's the sad state of it.
Wow.
And even if they wanted to, I mean, we have to assume that most doctors go into it because they're fundamentally good people and they want to heal people. But they're really not, they're barely allowed to help. What they have to do, if they don't subscribe, if the machine says you should subscribe XYZ pharmaceutical, if they don't subscribe that, and then the patient goes away and gets worse, or worst case dies, there could be a comeback on the doctor, because then the his supervisor is going to go, the machine told you to prescribe XYZ and you didn't, and the guy died. So there's a lot of pressure on doctors to do exactly as the machinery says.
Mm.
So I feel sorry for doctors. Then I don't have any envy at all of the position that they're in.
No.
And their system is also, it's fine for treating. The medical system is great if you get run over. You get run over by a bus, they're very good at scraping you off the road, taking you to the hospital, keeping you alive, fixing you with this sort of trauma care, and some of the excellent diagnostics that they've got. Some of that's fantastic. But where it really slips up is in the management and treatment of chronic disease, the understanding of chronic disease. Doctors don't really learn about mitochondria. You ask a doctor, even a recently qualified doctor, what is a mitochondria? He will simply over the cell, which is what you learn at school in O-level, A-level biology.
Yeah.
They don't have an understanding of mitochondrial dysfunction, which leads to mitochondrial-driven chronic diseases. And because that element is absent in their training, they completely misdiagnose all chronic diseases and they mistreat chronic diseases, which is why they don't have any success, which is why the biggest killers are heart disease, cancer, and neurodegeneration.
Mm.
Mitochondria in your body, we have them everywhere. But the biggest concentration is in our brain and in our heart. And then, so if you have mitochondrial dysfunction, you're going to get neurodegenerative problems first. You're going to get heart disease first. And if you get body-wide systemic mitochondrial dysfunction, that leads to cancer, because it's an energy problem across the body. And so those are the three biggest killers. And they're all mitochondrial diseases.
So before, Graham, before we wrap this up, give three things that the listeners can do to improve their overall holistic well-being.
Well, it's interesting you said three. Light, water, and magnetism. So that means it's back to that. It really is. You should see every sunrise, if possible. you should respect the sunset, meaning begin to do less things and block the blue light after sunset. So you've got to respect those two things. And then live your life in terms of sun exposure and food exposure. What food you eat should depend entirely on where you're living and what would have been available a couple of thousand years ago where you're living. So eat the type of food that would have been available in your local environment a few hundred years ago. So you shouldn't be living on imported foods. No. Yeah, you should be living on stuff which could and does grow around you.
And that's fairly, that isn't difficult to do. It just takes a bit of responsibility.
Yeah. And if you do that, if you do those three things, see the sunrise, respect the sunset and the following darkness, and you eat according to the food that would have been available in your area hundreds of years ago, you do those few things for just a couple of months, you will notice an improvement. You'll begin to realise that you're on the right track.
That's great. So, Graham, where can people find you and the Human Unleashed?
Well, as I was saying to Alex earlier, myself and three colleagues have come together to try to share information regarding health from an overwhelming sort of holistic, but it's not just holistic in the traditional sense of the word. It's we're looking at different inputs and everything. So there's four of us. The humanunleashed.com. If you go there at the moment, we've got there's lots of, we're doing some stuff on the COVID virus, and we've got some free videos, and we've got a free offer, a free sign up. Otherwise, we're trying to come to a sort of pricing structure where it's a subscription service where people have access to our content, and they all also have access to the four of us on a fortnightly basis with Q&As and stuff like that. So thehumanunleashed.com would be the page to go to. Sign up for free at the moment, have a delve into our content, see what you think. And if you consider signing up for the longer term, we'd love to see you in there.
It's highly recommended. Graham, thanks a lot for your time. Speak to you soon.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Cheers, Graham.
Cheers. Yeah.